Thank you to Capital Link and to Nicholas for allowing me to moderate the dry bulk panel today. My name is Chris Robertson. I'm Vice President of Equity Research for LNG Infrastructure and Maritime Shipping at Deutsche Bank. We have a pretty great panel today, in my estimation. Not only U.S.-listed companies, but also a foreign-listed company as well. So we're going to dive in today. Let me introduce our panel, Ms. Semiramis Palio of Diana Shipping. I don't see John here yet. Hopefully he'll join us as well. And Mr. John Wobensmith of Genco, Mr. Mark Filanowski of Pangea, Mr. Gautam Khurana of Pressure Shipping, which is a Bangkok-listed public company, Mr. Polos Hadjianu of Safe Bulkers, and Mr. Christos Begleris of Star Bulk, hopefully when he arrives as well. So in order to kick us off, if I could just go down the line here and have each of you introduce yourself, your company, specifically if you could comment when you were first publicly listed in the U.S. or otherwise, and we're going to get into a discussion about especially your experience with your investor base over time. So please introduce yourselves. Mark?
Mark Filanowski, Pangea Logistics Solutions, headquartered in Newport, Rhode Island. We've been public company since 2014. The company was formed in 1995 by a couple of people. They took it through the boom of the 2008 period and took on some private equity at that point and took it public in 2014. We're dry bulk operators and owners. We own 41 dry bulk ships ranging from handy size to post-Panamax size. We've got a few niches in ice class and we also do stevedoring and terminal services in about eight ports in the on the East Coast and Gulf Coast of the U.S.
Right.
How do we work this? Oh, it's on. Okay. Hello, my name is Semiramis Palios. I'm the CEO of Diana Shipping. Diana Shipping is a dry bulk shipping company listed on the New York Stock Exchange since 2005. This week we're actually celebrating 20 years. And so it's a big milestone for the company and for dry bulk shipping, I think, in general. We own and operate just under 40 ships. We've got two new building orders for dual fuel methanol Kamsarmax ships. That's our effort in pushing the industry towards a more sustainable industry and towards the future. We currently stand on a very strong balance sheet. We have $200 million US dollars in cash and just about 40% net debt. We are very optimistic about the future. Dry bulk is our core business, and we want to remain there for the next 20 years at least. Thank you.
Thank you. So, my name is Gautam Khurana. I'm CFO of Pressure Shipping. We are listed in the Stock Exchange of Thailand since 1993. We were formed in the late 1980s. We have a fleet of about 45 ships, including our new buildings. We operate worldwide in the Ultramax, Supermax, Handysize segment. We also have got cement carriers. So I think, like Semiramis said, I think we are also very optimistic about the future, but of dry bulk. I think we can get into that later on. But on your point about your question about investor sentiment, so just a little bit about that, because investors over here may not be so familiar with the Thailand stock market. So Thailand has a very vibrant stock market. So we have anything between within Southeast Asia, I would say we're the largest capital market. We've got, during good times, there's a lot of retail participation, and we have about 30 million shares that are traded every day. Now, during bad times, that drops down quite a bit to, right now, it's about 3 to 4 million shares that are traded every day. But then we also have a number of institutional investors, I guess, who are not trading, but they're still active in our stocks. So happy to be here. Thank you.
John, so just please introduce Genco when you were first publicly listed and just the state of the company today briefly.
Sure. Genco Shipping and Trading, we have 42 dry bulk vessels on the water, both major bulk on the Capesize side as well as our minor bulk fleet. And we really like the combination of the larger ships with, you know, more volatility and a higher beta, but also the mid-sized ships, which we have a very robust commercial trading platform that provides a more stable earning stream, but also allows us to create alpha above and beyond the Supermax index with the platform that we have in place. We think we're the best risk-reward model in shipping because of our low debt and low cash flow break-even, and we have a high dividend payout, very consistent. For the last 5.5 years, we've paid a dividend. I think we're one of the only ones in the peer group that have held true to that dividend formula. And again, as we look forward, we are very positive on the industry. We think this year might be a little bit slower, but as we get into 26 and 27, we think things are going to be pretty good.
Thanks, John. Polis?
Yes, good morning from me. I'm the CEO of Safe Bulkers. We are listed 17 years since 2008 in New York Stock Exchange. The family comes from Cyprus, and our headquarters are in Cyprus. I believe we are the only New York Stock Exchange company from the island. First of all, congratulate Diana Shipping for reaching 20 years.
Thank you.
And Palios family. Mr. Palios was very good friend with my father, late father. And also wish to Precious Shipping as well our best for the recent victims in an earthquake in Thailand. So we listed with 11 ships and 9 new buildings in 2008. Despite the difficult years of 2012 to 2020, which was low years in dry bulk with oversupplied market, we all know about that. We have reached today 46 ships and 7 new buildings, and they are all in the sizes of 75,000 to 180,000 deadweight. We have renewed our fleet the last few years, despite the bad market of the previous decade. We have 30 ships, either with electronic engines or Phase 3, Tier 3 new buildings out of the 53. And we are trying to, in the next couple of years, to manage to increase that further. So basically, this is where we stand at the moment.
Thank you. So since we're at Capital Link, I thought I would ask some questions related to capital markets and your investor base. So I wanted to start with a question of, based on your experience in not only recent years, but over various cycles, in terms of the U.S. investor base, and then we'll have a discussion with Mr. Khurana as well about his investor base. How has the investor base changed over time in terms of investor sentiment, knowledge of the sector? How has that trended over time? What is investors' key concerns and kind of the makeup of your investor base? I'm going to start with Mark.
Well, I guess I've got the most gray hair on the panel, so I can say that I've been involved in public markets since the 1970s. My first public exposure in shipping was in the late 1980s, early 90s. I remember one name from back then was OSG Corporation. It was pretty much considered an industrial company. They had a tanker fleet and a bulker fleet. They consistently reinvested in the fleet, renewed it, grew it. Then the age of, I guess, pure play came about. And they divested of their bulker fleet and concentrated on tankers. And they took that a little farther some years later when they split up their Jones Act business from their international flag business. Some mistakes were made that led to reorganization of the company, but the sentiment was moving at that time from pure play to, I think, more speculation, asset play speculation. The boom of the early 2000s up to 2008, people were buying shipping stocks for the asset moves, the speculation in the stocks. After 2008, I think today maybe we're more toward, shipping stocks trade pretty much as a proxy for the BDI, or the bulk shipping stocks do. Track the BDI, track the shipping stocks, you'll see they move up and down. People play the market now for the most part. There are still some long-term investors out there, including the founders of my business that are still long-term holders in the company, and including the 28% shareholders that we just took on when we bought the equity of 15 ships, and it's 15 handy ships back in January. So there are some long-term players out there, but I think people like to play the cycles now.
John?
I think, so I agree with everything that Mark said, and that was a very good summary. What we have seen, at least in Genco, is a shift of longer-term investors not playing ball. I actually think long-term investors outside of ship owners, but actual hedge funds, mutual funds, shipping is out of favor at this point. And what we're seeing is index funds are the major holder of our shares, and I think some of the other shares on the panel as well, because they have to hold our shares basis, obviously, what they're investing in. But when I look at how things are played in the industry now, it's based on volatility, and I think it's short term. Unfortunately, I don't think there are any real long-term investors. I mean, if I look at this room right now, absent anybody who is a ship owner in here, somebody who is a mutual fund or a family office or someone along those lines, how many people have owned dry bulk stocks for a year or more in this room? Raise your hands. One, two, three. No. You're not a fund. So, you know, again, very small number that are long-term holders in this industry, and I think we've got to figure out how to get back to, again, family offices, maybe not so much the big guys like a Wellington or a Fidelity, but really promoting dividend structures, low leverage, and the fact that most of these companies are trading at very steep discounts to net asset value and breakup value, for that matter.
Great. Ms. Pelley?
Well, there isn't really much I can add, apart from the fact that I think as a company, our timing when we listed in 2005 was exceptional. We rode the ride of an incredible shipping market and an incredible interest from the capital market as well. We managed in that period to raise more than $700 million U.S. dollars, which was exceptional years. I mean, there was incredible interest. Unfortunately, as the gentlemen before me have said, the interest has dropped. The shipping market isn't that exciting anymore or sexy. So unfortunately, we have to ride the wave and hope for better times. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Karama, same question to you as it relates to your investor base, just perceptions over time, how it's changed and your experience with it.
Sure. So I think like one of the speakers just said, our stock is also traded as a proxy for the BDI, which doesn't really make a lot of sense in our case because the BDI is heavily skewed towards the Capesize sector and we have no Capes. We have no Panamaxes. We are in the smaller bulk segment. Also, in terms of, as I mentioned, so in terms of volume, I think I reckon about maybe 85-90% of investors are there for short-term movements. But there is at least in our experience, maybe 10 or 15% of the investors are there for the long term. So that's something we see.
Christos, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely, thank you for having me. Well, it goes in cycles, really, and I will start going back to maybe 2014 when you had a wave of big private equity players being interested in dry bulk, some of them forming JVs on the private side, acquiring fleets, and then really looking to exit in 2017 or 2018, and Star Bulk was able to acquire some fleets through shares transactions back then. And then in 2015, 2016, when the markets were really weak, we saw a lot of the deep value, so-called hedge funds, circling our space. And you can see quite a few of those even today. Then in 2021 and 2022, when the freight markets were more constructive, we actually saw a lot of the institutional investors circling our space, I think all of us here were happy because the likes of Fidelity were building large positions in our companies. But to our surprise, most of those long-term institutional investors stayed with us only for a few months, making some really good profits and then exiting our industry. I would say that money managers unfortunately need big companies in order to invest. We hear often of some big money managers telling us that they need the ability to invest up to $200, $300, $400 million tickets in order for them to justify putting the effort, the research into the companies that they study. And therefore, this calls for consolidation in our space. And I think that we're going to be seeing this more and more in the future.
Thank you.
Boss?
Yes, we don't see many investors in the room, indeed, apart from ourselves, ship owners. We have bought in the last 2-3 years maybe around 20 million shares of our own stock for the company, so we are investing. The other people, of course, we understand why they don't invest. Dry bulk is not on the radar. It's all about China. Everybody's talking negatively about China. I have my doubts if we should be so negative about Chinese growth and about development of that country and the role it has to play on raw commodities and movement. I remember in 2008 when we entered the stock market before Lehman Brothers, it was a different world. In 2009 when Lehman crashed, I don't believe that we held the conference here in 2009. I don't remember if we had one. Maybe Olga can help us. Nick, we did. We were on 2009, between us maybe. Between us. Then we had the stimulus of which country? China pushed things up again, and we have a brilliant 4 years. The funds were interested. They put money in the dry bulk companies. Even we were made a repeat add-ons, all the companies, all the dry bulk companies. Even we issued the preferred shares, the perpetual preferreds, which was a class that I don't think is available again. And then 2014, all this stopped. We had the crisis, the oversupplied market, 7-8 years of bad market. And when we came back 2021, 2024 with the COVID and the market flourished again and we went up, again, the funds were not there and the investors were not there because they wouldn't believe in China. We had the first trade war, which killed off the expectations. And anything we would hear about China was negative. So, indeed, from 2014 onwards, we remember very, very little people involved in investing in dry bulk shipping. I think it's a mistake because now the market is evenly balanced, supply and demand. It's not a big order book. The regulations are getting tougher and tougher. At a certain point, if market drops, immediately you will see scrapping going on. The environmental regulations are there. I think that everyone at today's prices is doing a big mistake for not investing in dry bulk companies. Certainly we are doing, other public companies are doing the same. It's a non-brainer. So I'm very optimistic as well that the next 2-3 years we'll see good things coming out of this sector.
You know, so Paulus brings up one point that I just wanted to emphasize. It's really interesting. Not even a year ago, most of these companies were trading very close to NAV. Values were about the same. Freight rates were about the same. So what has happened between, and as Paula said, I think the industry is even more positive looking going forward now than what we saw last year. One of the things, I think this equity group, whether it's dry or tankers or even containers, gets painted broadly with China. And I think there's a very significant China off trade going on right now. And unfortunately, shipping, when you screen shipping, it's about China. So I think that's, Paulus, you started to touch on that. I think that's a very important point and an opportunity at this point.
That's a great point. Yeah, we'll try to get to the topic of China in a moment here. But Just as a follow-up, many of you mentioned the shorter-term nature of certain investors and playing the BDI and your equities as proxies. But with regards to attracting investors, how is your company differentiating itself from its peers and trying to break out from that mold?
I guess we look to investors who might appreciate us operating in niches that deliver a little extra premium, long-term contracts that provide a steady base and maybe protect the downside, a logical business plan. That's why we're trying to get involved in more in the supply chain. So people who appreciate that kind of effort, but it's not easy to explain to everybody. They've got to learn about our niches if they want to believe in it. They've got to trust us in terms of the long-term contracts and the way we put those contracts together. And they've got to understand how ocean transport fits into stevedoring and terminal services. So all these things that add extra margin and a little consistency to our performance are difficult to explain to the average investor who really just wants an overnight love affair.
John?
The most important thing is consistency. That's what investors want, a consistent message. We think that we have done that. We put our value strategy in place in early 2021. Things started looking very positive in dry bulk after that. And while we saw a lot of our peers increase their dividends, and I would tell you, sitting as a CEO and not doing it, our stock price lagged at that point. But we took that cash, we paid down our debt significantly so that we're now down to net debt of 5% from a leverage factor. And then once that debt was paid down, we put that dividend case into play. And as I've said, we've paid dividends for 5.5 years now consecutively. So we think that we have, with the low leverage, the low cash flow break even, and holding by our consistent message and doing what we said we're going to do, we've created the best risk reward model in dry bulk shipping, publicly traded anyway.
Yes, well, there's often a disconnect between what the investors want and what the interests of the company are, whether they are short-term or long-term investors. We try and maintain a disciplined strategy, good visibility with our earnings, and we consider that Diana is a good offers a good reward risk platform. This is all I can say.
Mr. Cronin, before you respond to the question, can you describe your immediate pure play peer group in your exchange?
In our exchange, there's just one other dry bulk company, which is Thor Sentai, which is actually a handy-sized Supermax player, which is somewhat smaller than us. But yeah, just to answer your question, so how do we attract investors, if you will? So I think our message to investors is very simple. So we were listed in 1993. If you had invested in our stock in 1993, if you held on to it until today, enjoyed all the dividends until today, you would have earned essentially a 15.5% IRR. So that is really a very simple reason, I think, for investors to hold on to our stock. Also, in terms of things like corporate governance, I think we perform quite well. We've been rated 5-star. We've got a 5-star corporate governance rating from the Thailand Stock Exchange for the last 15 years. Also under the S&P Corporate Sustainability Assessment, SESG rating, we're also in the top 12% of global transportation companies. In the previous panel, somebody talked about shipping companies moving towards becoming carbon neutral. We are actually already a carbon neutral company under our Scope 1 and Scope 2.
So I think that shareholders of Star Bulk or potential shareholders of Star Bulk have to look at the sort of unique combination of the following elements. First of all, as far as size is concerned, we have a liquidity of around $35 million being traded per day, given that around 2 million shares change hands every day. And this means that bigger shareholders are able to come in and out of our company without affecting the share price for the rest of the shareholders. Then we're very cost conscious. Like our friends at Safe Bulkers, this does not mean cutting corners. On the opposite, the RightShip rating of our vessels is amongst the highest in our industry, but we are very much on top, and being on top of costs and G&A means more EBITDA available for our shareholders. In the last 2 years, we have distributed $1.3 billion in dividends, and at the same time, we have bought back more than 22 million of our shares. Therefore, we have also a very shareholder-friendly culture, looking to be accretive to our shareholders as much as possible. On top of that, at Starbulk, we have the governance that you would expect from a U.S.-listed company. Our board is very diverse, being composed of also from other ship owners, from transactions that we have done throughout the years, whether Norwegian or Italian ship owners. And I think also Starbulk has a unique track record of having bought more than 100 vessels using our shares as currency. So we have issued our shares at net asset value or even a premium to net asset value, thereby renewing our fleet, making the pie larger, and hopefully adding value for our shareholders.
Yes, I think every company is a little bit different from each other. It all starts from what is the perspective and what is the aim of each company. In the case of Safe Bulkers, our key word is sustainability. We want to have a company that is sustainable in the long run. That's why we pay attention on the eco vessels and on the fleet renewal process with what we have available right now in front of us, which are the Phase 3, Tier 3 vessels. And over the years, what we try to demonstrate to investors, and we communicate on every opportunity, is that we have our money at stake in this company. We own around 50% of the company. We have our own money there. So we are there to defend it and keep it sustainable for the next generation, for years to come. I think this is the main goal of our company. We are paying dividends since 2021. We are doing, as I said before, a buyback of our shares when the prices are low and when there is pessimism in the market. So you don't really need to buy ships. If you can buy at 50% of NAV or less your own stock. We are heavily invested in this company, and we have not sold a single share of the family in the last 17 years that we have been public. We said that, we promised that from the start, that we will defend this company to the end. We never make a reverse split or any other activities. We didn't need to do, and we would never do, as long as we are on top of things. So I think the word is sustainability as far as our company is concerned.
Thank you. This is a bit of an introspective question for myself, but in your experience with dealing with equity analysts, especially on the sell side, what do we get wrong and what do we get right? What can we do better to improve items of disclosure, forecasting, or analysis to better help attract and inform investors into the dry bulk space? And no need to mention specific analysts, especially if you have complaints.
Well, I think analysts, when they look at a company, they, if it's a relatively simple business plan, like a tonnage provider, then you can look at things like NAV, return over a period of time. And it's pretty simple to model out. But a company like ours is a lot more difficult, as I mentioned earlier. So we're kind of hard to figure out because we're involved in different segments of the dry bulk. Post-Panamax is different than Handysize. In between, we've got a large array of Supras. We're an owner, but we're also an operator. We own 41 ships, but we operate a total of 60 or 80 every day through short-term charters in the market. So somebody has to have a real feel for the underlying market to understand us And I think taking a little time to do that would be worth it for an analyst to get to know the business plan for some of these companies rather than just the easy to manage tonnage provider, 41 ships times $15,000 a day or whatever your assumed rate is, figure out what EPS is and do a multiple. It's a lot harder with a company like mine, unfortunately, but we think it's the bigger way, the better and bigger way to go to lift us out of this trough of NAV valuation. We'd like to be considered more like OSG used to be as a more industrial play.
John?
All right. So no names, but you did ask for
my name, John.
You did ask for some criticisms. May not be the right word. It's more about what can be done better. And I think so. Certainly, nobody likes to see downgrades on stocks. But in the end of the day, that's not what keeps us up at night. Analysts are going to put buys, they're going to put holds, they're going to put sells. However, a lot of times, at least in dry bulk, you have this piling on effect. So you'll have one or two of the analysts that, have an opinion, whether it's up or whether it's down. Obviously, if it's down, that's where we start to wake up a little bit. They pile on. And so you have this cascading effect. And we would much rather see more thought go into it than just, oh, well, this guy's done it, this woman's done it, let's all downgrade the sector as a whole. And we've definitely seen some of that in the last couple of years. And again, we don't think the fundamentals necessarily support that. What also that we focus on, we put a ton of information out there. We are a U.S. filer. Highly transparent. We give you OPEX for the next quarter. We give you G&A, and then by the end of the quarter, from a calendar standpoint, we put out our TCE rate, which is usually anywhere from 95% to 98% fixed. So there's not a lot of math that needs to be done to get to an EPS number and even a dividend number. But yet, there does tend to be a disconnect. These analysts all have 30, 50 companies they're covering, so they're probably way overworked. But we're a pretty simple story, and particularly because we're putting those numbers out at the end of the quarter, there are times where it's still they just don't get it right. And that's what we scratch our head at, I think, the most.
Yeah, we find, I'm generalizing here, but we find that there are two types of analysts, those who are more focused on the capital markets and those that have more knowledge of the shipping industry. And usually it's separated between the U.S. analysts and the Scandinavian analysts being more shipping savvy. It's hard. We feel that we have a very visible company with long-term visibility of our earnings. Simple for an analyst to understand, but they don't always get it. Net asset value is the most common way of evaluating the company. There are some shortfalls. I think most importantly, it doesn't always take into account the management skills, the future vision, qualitative issues, and market conditions.
Yeah, so just speaking generally now, I think so over the last few years, there's been a lot of media coverage about the slowdown in China. And yes, that's true. But I think that slowdown was primarily on the consumer side, not really on the industrial side. And yes, okay, the property sector took quite a big hit, and iron ore demand reduced, because specifically to the property sector, iron ore demand reduced. What analysts, I think, didn't foresee is that when such downturns take place in China, generally the government stimulates the economy. They invest more in infrastructure. There was also tremendous demand for steel for shipbuilding. The automobile industry, as we know, China is now the biggest manufacturer of cars in the world. What they also, I guess, didn't foresee is that coal demand would take off the way it did, both in India as well as in China over the last few years. That's been a huge driver of growth. I think many people have been saying that coal is dead, it's going to be on the decline, but actually it's been growing. So, you know, that's a fantastic story. I think even on something like grains are growing incredibly well. So I think people tend to be sometimes a bit too pessimistic, and I think we're probably at that sort of stage right now in terms of the pendulum. We're more on the pessimistic side.
So first of all, I would ask for less reshuffling, please, in the analyst community. In the last year, it's been okay, but there was a period before that when we saw analysts coming in and out of our general shipping industry. You need people dedicated to this industry in order to understand the space and be able to understand the companies that they cover. Secondly, I would say it would be very helpful if analysts expressed their view more clearly on whether they're pro or against the fundamentals of a specific industry and their views. I think you have sometimes analysts not being clear enough on whether the specific industry is a buy or sell. And I think it would help institutional investors if analysts were clearer on their views. Third, I would say that analysts should be also more clear about making a differentiation on companies that have had behaved in a shareholders friendly way versus companies that have not behaved in a shareholders friendly way. I think that's important for investors. And finally, I would say that analysts should also get closer to institutional investors and act many times as a bridge between us companies and institutional investors. I think if you guys were closer, we would have more institutional investors looking at our space.
Awesome.
Yeah, look, when we started 18 years ago in the public markets, there were so many analysts, I don't even remember their names. And now we know there are two or three covering our company. We know one, we know even their address and their telephone numbers. It's the times. I mean, we can do nothing. There are no offerings, there are no add-ons, there's no business generated the last 10 years, very little business. I mean, we managed to do a very good issuance of a bond in the Greek market, in the Greek stock exchange in 2022, at an all-in cost of 295. We haven't done anything in the U.S., if I remember well, the last 10 years. So we have two or three analysts. We try to guide them. You know, the guys are doing their best. I don't think that this will change anytime soon. It's the banks, they don't commit money to the sector until the time that they will see business to be done. If our stocks are trading at 45, 50, 55, 60% of NAV, no one will issue shares. I don't see bright future for the analysts. But I believe this may change as the market becomes more tight over the years. As I said before, it's not an oversupplied market as we had in the previous decade. The regulations are getting tougher and tougher. Many companies will not be able to follow the changes. Even listed companies, we are spending more and more money and resources, and we have more people working for us, our management companies, in order to cope with the changes that are coming against us. I don't want to touch the base of the case of decarbonization, because maybe you have another question, but I mean, there are so many different things the last 3 or 4 years that are developing that simply you need to commit more money towards all these things. This will create a tighter market and a better freight rates.
Let's move on to the current geopolitical environment, and then we'll go on to supply and demand fundamentals. So as you look at the landscape today in terms of geopolitical risk and opportunity with regards to trade wars, tariff, and shifting global trade patterns, is this a headwind, tailwind, or a bit of mix of both? And if you could talk about specific commodities and your views around this topic.
When the tariffs were first announced, I said to myself, this isn't a big problem because markets will adjust, goods still have to move, it'll be okay. But then the U.S. trade rep shoe dropped on my head and impacts us, all of us, I think, directly, potentially. That is a headwind of hurricane strength, I think, in the short term, if it comes through the way it happens. The long term, I think it might actually be a strong tailwind. The inefficiencies that will develop from that kind of action against ocean transportation will cause a lot of disruption and inefficiencies, and people who have good fleets will benefit, I think, long term. In terms of if building ships in China becomes disincentivized enough, and there is a long term drop in orders from China, I don't know where the ships are going to come from that are needed for our industry. So again, a longer term tailwind could develop here. In terms of what commodities are impacted, is probably the ones that come to and from China. In our segments, we're not directly related to cargo moving in and out of China, but of course, every ship in the ocean is somewhat impacted by China. So John, I'm sure, would have a lot more to add to that.
Yeah, John?
Well, I think we're in chaos theory right now. It's as simple as that. I don't think we really know the implications. Part of that is because we don't know what the USTR is going to propose ultimately and what the administration is going to sign off on. I agree with Mark. I think disruption and inefficiencies will come out of this, and that always tends to be good for shipping. And I don't think there's anything different here. The question is what happens on the short term. We've certainly, even today, we've seen a real slowdown of U.S. Exports and imports, for that matter. And what's getting done now is really business that was booked a couple months ago and cargo that has to be moved. We've also, interestingly enough, we've done two fixings over the last week and a half, and we have been able to pass through any port fees that will come forward to the cargo owner. And so I actually, depending on how much those port fees are in the end of the day, I do unfortunately think it could be short-term demand destructive for U.S. cargoes, and that's grains in particular. That's the one that we're very focused on. Having said that, it just means more buying will shift to Brazil and Argentina, and while from a seasonal standpoint things may change, I'm not so worried about overall demand for dry bulk shipping because of this. I actually think this is, again, I think it's more hurtful to U.S. companies than it is punishing the Chinese, though we're very much in favor of revitalizing the U.S. shipping industry from a shipyard standpoint in particular. But I think you have to at least look at the challenges, and we need the infrastructure, which could take easily a decade on the short term. You need the skilled workforce to work in those shipyards, and then we need crew. And we're lacking on all three of those, and unfortunately, that it's not like turning a key, you know, just putting straight tariffs on goods. I think it's a very different proposition. So I've gone all over the place, but we have an opinion on it, obviously, and I will pass it to you.
Very challenging times indeed, and we don't know what news we'll hear on our phones the next day. So things are very fluid, and I think no one can actually speculate. What I can reiterate, though, is that shipping paradoxically usually thrives on disruptions, and so this is definitely a very disruptive environment. There are possibilities of retaliatory tariffs as well, so we cannot dismiss that. Maybe what I would like to add to this discussion is something I've recently realized about the Chinese stimulus expectations that we've all been placing a lot of hope. It will revive the dry bulk commodities trade once again. I've recently realized that the Chinese stimulus is actually taking place, but it's taking place in a very different sector than what would help the dry bulk, support the dry bulk. It's taking place in artificial intelligence, in renewable energy, in biotechnology. Apparently, they're about to produce a new drug, a cancer drug. And another thing is that they're having demographic shrinkage, which means that the population is shrinking, so they have less need for new infrastructures and buildings. So what do you? So, I mean, I don't know. It's an interesting time that we are entering.
Very interesting points.
So I echo what my co-panelists have said. The one thing that could happen with all this uncertainty is there will be potentially lower ordering of particularly dry bulk ships that will take place in China. China today has the maximum capacity for shipbuilding for in the dry bulk space. About 75% of ships that are under construction in our sector are being built in China. If that building of new ships, which I don't think is a big problem, I agree with Paulus, the order book is not a huge problem, but if it reduces further, then that's obviously a potential tailwind in the long run. Or just to add on China again, so just to give some figures. There's still about 500 million people in China who live in rural areas. And every year about 20 to 25 million people move into urban areas. And all these people need to be housed. And so that's been the driver of dry bulk steel demand over the last 20 years. That trend is not reversing. Today only about 40% of people who live in urban areas in China live in modern housing, defined as housing that's built after the 1990s. So a good 60% of people living in urban areas live in housing which is old. So they need steel. So I think this the China story, iron ore, I think that will continue for many, many years to come.
So first of all, to echo what my co-panelists have said, that short-term tariffs are potentially positive because they create a reshuffling of trade and they create inflationary pressure on commodities, and high commodity prices are good news for dry bulk shipping. Now, in the long term, Asemira has touched a very good point, and that is retaliatory tariffs. For example, China has announced 15% on U.S. coal. China has also announced 25% tariffs on U.S. soybeans. That means that you effectively are going to see a reshuffling of trade in coal as well as soybeans from the U.S. going to different parts of the world and not China. Potentially for this year, if those tariffs come into place, we're going to see a better grain season for South America and potentially a weaker grain season for the U.S. in the fourth quarter of this year. Overall, it's a volatile times. Volatility is good for shipping. It's good for us. But I believe that the long-term effect of tariffs and especially retaliatory tariffs is potentially destructive for the demand in our industry.
Yes, I think that headwinds are in front of us, but there are opportunities as well. Always headwinds were creating opportunities, and all the anomalies in shipping we have experienced the last 4 or 5 years, many of those have added value to freight rates. So this will continue to happen. Of course, will be ups and downs. If China imposes tariffs on U.S. soybeans, that will be a big hit. On the other hand, the Chinese will import the stuff from Brazil or other countries. What will happen? Ships will get in Brazil. Instead of turning around in 5 days they are doing now, they will be spending there five weeks. So this will will help again freight rates. So overall, we are not pessimistic. I think in the short term, as Christos said, will be positive. Already we're experiencing market of 20% higher than the previous months, the previous 6 months, or even 30% in some cases. The most important is, as I said before, to have a sustainable company, to have done some fleet renewal. We are lucky as Safe Bulkers is building 80. We have 85% of our new buildings we built in Japan, and 15% only in China. We don't know what we will do with this 15%. Maybe we sell in the next few years if this is a true story that is playing now with the Chinese built ships. Who knows what will happen? You know, it's but usually when there is headwinds and there is a lot of talk that this will happen, the other will happen, always there is some opportunity. So long you have a young fleet, sustainable, with a good consumption, I mean low consumption and low emissions, I think the companies who are at that position, most of the companies on the table here, I think they are well placed. These companies are worth investing in, and there will be opportunities to come.
And just a final point, we touched upon tariffs, we touched upon port fees. We heard Mr. Trump being very angry at Putin during the weekend for a resolution in the Ukraine war. A resolution in the Ukrainian war is definitely a positive for dry bulk shipping, given resumption of the grain trade out of the Ukraine. I don't see a resumption of coal trade from Russia to Europe anytime soon, given the decarbonization push in Europe. And therefore, this should be also a short-term positive for our industry.
Thank you, Christos. We have just a few minutes left, so I'm going to do a bit of a quick lightning round, last question. This question was designed with Hamish Norton in mind, but of course, Christos is speaking on the panel instead. But still, I think you would appreciate it. Net asset value, outdated crutch or useful metric? If not NAV, what valuation methodology is the most useful?
My old boss, Ed Cole, God rest his soul, used to say it's just a bird on a wire when it came to things like NAV. If you have a fleet and you're not going to sell it today, what difference does NAV make today based on a return of a long-term investment in a shipping stock? Shouldn't you be looking at consistent cash flow and the business plan and looking at the future instead of just looking at NAV today?
Very quickly, you go back to 2010 to 2020 where, you know, this industry had very low, if negative cash flows. There was only NAV to look at, right? And so that's where a lot of this has come from. But now that companies have delevered significantly, cash flows are certainly positive where we are today. I think looking at enterprise value to EBITDA multiples, looking at even PE multiples at this point, NAV should be in there, but it really should be a full capture of all the valuation techniques in my mind to value a stock. NAV changes every single day. I agree with Ed very much so on how he looks at that. And I think dividend yield is important, but the dividend yield is be careful what you wish for. I think a lot of these are unfortunately priced on at least next quarter's dividend yield. But we need to start looking forward again as we feel getting into next year, particularly the second half of next year with new volume coming on. The super low order book. I mean, it's amazing, and I know I'm off topic here, but I do want to get this out because it is about supply for this industry. 20 years and plus on the water today, that's 10% of the fleet. Well, guess what? The order book is only 10% of the fleet. So you have a true period where it is just simply replacement. There's no growth coming over the next several years from the order book.
Well, I'll go back to the net asset value question.
Sure.
It's a most commonly and transparent method of benchmarking. I agree with what you've just mentioned. It has its shortfalls, but I think that's the only method at the moment that the market uses.
So I think NAV is a good starting point, but of course it ignores things as soft factors, should I say. So that, let's say, the track record of management, the dividend track record of the company. It ignores maybe the corporate governance scores of the company. So, yeah.
Christos?
Well, just to add that, I mean, NAV is most representative for liquidation, but as Gautam said, it does not recognize the value added by management. And if in the long term we are unable to trade, at least for a significant amount of time, above NAV, that's a strong message to us. Going on dividend yield that was touched by John, it would be great if we could trade on a dividend yield. However, there is just too much volatility, especially in the spot dry bulk market, in order for us to be able to justify trading on dividend yield. As far as a constructive sort of method nowadays for valuating us, I would say that right now FFA curves are pretty constructive. They're pretty stable. So one could attempt to derive the net present value using the FFA curves and using the appropriate discount rates. I think that these potentially could get to much proper values for dry bulk companies than what we have today when we have only valuations with a sticker for NAVs.
Carlos, I want to respect you as well, and we are out of time, but...
Yes, I have nothing more to add. I think NAV is usually the method that we calculate. And, of course, the important is the track record of each management company, how much hands-on you are on the business. If you run the business as a family business, that you take care of each problem, that you are involved in each fixture of the ships, you decide with which charterer you do, with which charterers you build up relationships, and the most important also that the family or the major shareholders is fully aligned with the rest of the shareholders. If you have a good stake in the company, it means you are fully aligned and you will do the best for that company. So over the next few years there will be opportunities. We are here now, we are at a good base. We were not in that good base in 2012, 2013. We all knew, but we kept ordering ships because the industry asked for us to do that, eco-ships, do that, to the other. We knew that the market was oversupplied. We kept going. I mean, basically, we were doing what everyone else was doing in a smaller scale or whatever. And now we're at the point that, as John said, it's a very, very comfortable supply scenario. If we want to order a ship now in Japan, we have to wait for 2029. In China, they built the ships for themselves for 2027, 2028, and those ships will come in the market and they will not be able to trade the U.S. So all this, for me, is good news. We have to be patient and get our chances when they hit the door. You know, we reply to this good piece of fortune that will come in front of us.
All right, I want to thank our panelists today. Thank you to Capital Link, and thank you all for your attention, especially heading into lunchtime. Thank you.